because you have long given up waiting as a state of mind. So you're not waiting for anything. Talked about the impersonal nature of the pain body. We looked at that. And just as impersonal really is a stream of thinking. It's thought. Nobody's personal problem. Well, that's a relief. It's not my problem. The fact that my mind won't stop isn't my problem. It's the human mind. And then it stops because you've given it space. Let's look at a few questions. I'll start with the smallest piece of paper. It's a short question, so that's good. By dissolving the ego, won't I be dissolving my self-esteem? Do I not need self-esteem to love myself and others? Yes, self-esteem. Many people seem to have a problem with that. Lack of self-esteem. I read a while ago that when the Dalai Lama was younger, he was meeting with a group of Westerners and they were talking about the lack of self-esteem, and he just couldn't understand that, what that was, and they tried to explain it, and then he went around the group and asked everybody, do you have that? And most people said yes. Oh, it's very strange, self-esteem. The human species, the only species on the planet, of course, that has a relationship with itself, where you have a relationship with yourself. That's normal. doesn't have a relationship with itself, or the bird doesn't have a relationship with itself, or the tree doesn't. So birds, cats, trees, monkeys, flowers, none of them have a problem with self-esteem, and even the most ugly looking cat wouldn't have a problem with self-esteem. It hasn't created a secondary, an image self, mind created, and once, of course, that's created, it walks with you, like next to you, behind you, or wherever it is. You always walk with a mental image of me, and you have a relationship with that. And often, you don't like what you see, the image self. That's poor self-esteem. And then you may be in conflict with it, with the self. You may be talking to yourself in the head, telling yourself something about yourself. Some people talk to themselves in the first person, but many more people talk to themselves in the second person, as you. You see? You failed again. You see? You are not as good as. You see? You. Why can't you? And then at times, perhaps the self feels suddenly great about itself. Some people predominantly have low self-esteem, in other words, feel bad about the mind-made image me, feel bad about that, and then realize that some realization comes in when they realize that it is mind-created, and they realize, and usually in the West, it's connected with New Age teachings, and they realize that they can do something about their bad self-esteem, the image. You can actually change your thinking about yourself. First, you discover that the thinking about yourself is predominantly, or to a large extent, negative. And then, you see, that's a little bit of presence is arising. It must be, because you are able to stand back a little bit and watch and see what you are creating with your thoughts. And then the possibility comes of changing your thoughts, your self-esteem, through workshops, affirmations, visualization, and all those practices. And then after a while, that image looks a little bit more comfortable. You feel more comfortable with that thing walking alongside you. But since everything in form, all mind creations, thoughts are subject to polarities, you can't walk with a high, continuously with high self-esteem and feel great about yourself. There's always a polarity to it. And it's usually bound up with what happens or not happens in your life, what feedback you're getting from others. And it is usually comparative. The self-esteem is comparative. How do I rate myself in relation to others? And that gives you the indication of where you are on 1 to 10, or whatever it may be. So self-esteem is mind is connected with the mind-made me, lack of it or in good self-esteem, but it exists within polarities. Even if you spend a whole year affirming continuously that I love myself, and maybe until now you hated yourself, and your house is full of little stickers, and wherever you look, you see I love myself, and you look in the mirror and look into your eyes and repeat that I love myself. To some extent, it works. To some extent, you have a better relationship with yourself. But there's always a downside. It's hard to sustain that because the other polarity will manifest also in your life. And you go through life when, in order to know how you feel about yourself, you need to compare yourself with others. And then you say, oh, I'm actually better looking than this person, so I actually feel quite good about myself. I'm actually much more educated than that person, I feel good about, or whatever you can get. Well, this person is ill and I'm healthy, so that's good. So you need, for self-esteem, if you look, you need relativity. And you need comparison. And ego is always comparing itself. Is it possible to live without having a relationship with yourself? Neither good nor bad. Is it possible to be so completely yourself that the mind-made image of me dissolves? Yes, this is why we're here. This is the essence of our gathering. The mind-made image is connected to thought, to continuous thinking. It's fueled by, perpetuated by, upheld by the continuous thought processes, many of which are about me and myself. And so I have a relationship with a thought-made entity, which sometimes feels quite comfortable and sometimes feels not pleasant, don't want to live with that person. And of course it's true, many people live with a self that is very unpleasant, that creates a lot of trouble, a lot of problems, a lot of suffering, that continuously criticizes them, that continuously blames them, that continuously tells them they're not enough. And they live with that entity, mind-made, conditioned mind movements, conditioned in such a way that they attack you continuously, and that's the self that they have a relationship with. They would never live with a person like that. You would run out of the room. You couldn't live with a person for more than a day. Somebody you live with did that to you, what your self-image is doing to you through thought, you would have filed for divorce long ago. But you can't do that with that because it's your own, the mind. It walks with you. And there you have this complaining and whining and accusing and, oh, get away. And a part of that is because you're identified with thought. There isn't the ability to step back from thought and watch thought. Watch that. And here, the mind-made entity, because that self that you have a relationship with is part of the story-based self, the me. That was the self that I had a very unpleasant relationship with for many years. I had a very extremely painful relationship with myself. I couldn't live with myself anymore. And so I somehow said, that's it. I can't live with it anymore. That's it. But that was so total that I no longer sustained, fueled the self through thought. I didn't know anything about it. It just happened. So the mind-made image dissolved. The self that I couldn't live with, that was so heavy, dissolved. And what was left was simply I. So the I shifted from, whereas before when I said I was referring to myself, the unhappy, dense I, the story-based I, that dissolved, and then the true I emerged, had always been there. Presence, I am. Nothing in particular anymore, a simple sense of presence, of beingness. And for the first time I could walk and be without having a relationship with myself. And that there is something so precious in that I or presence. So it's beyond words, you could say. It's like a diamond. It's something extremely, very, very precious. That's why perhaps Buddhism sometimes has the image of a diamond. But this is not comparative. It's not a sense of that deepest self, not the mind-made self, is so precious that it has, it knows itself to be that in a non-dualistic way without needing to compare itself to others. It has nothing to do with a form or any mind form. So as presence arises, you don't need self-esteem anymore, you don't depend on that anymore. Because what dissolves is the mind-made entity with which you have a relationship. And it's so self-esteem is an intermediate thing that for a little while makes your life more pleasant. It's fine. And then after a while you see the unsatisfactory nature even of that, because you cannot uphold continuous self-esteem. It's hard work, all these affirmations. And then things come into your life that tell you the opposite, inevitably, sooner or later. So then suddenly you don't love yourself anymore, nor do you hate yourself, because there's no self to love. There's simply the state of this, which is love. It emanates. But you don't create a fiction that now you have a good relationship and love. So that is moving beyond self-esteem. And now we see why the Dalai Lama couldn't understand. He only learned about that concept when he met Westerners who have a highly developed mind and ego. Not others also have ego, but even more developed in the West, perhaps. But he was surrounded perhaps by monks and not quite as highly developed mental image. And perhaps he himself maybe never had it, or I don't know. But anyway, it was new to him, self-esteem. How strange. And I write about it in the book. There's a little paragraph on that. The end of having a relationship with yourself. You don't need to arrange certain thoughts in your head that you feel good about. So self-esteem is replaced by something deeper and more real. That I'm able to surrender to many things, but there are some things that I still struggle with. In particular, my pain body still reacts vigorously to injustice of all kinds, particularly abuse of power and cruelty to animals. And people who still insist on saving seats here at the front of the hall with their books or clothing, despite being requested not to do so. And it's always the same people. So I won't talk about the last part of the question. It's enough that I read it. But the first part... Reacting to injustice of all kinds, particularly abuse of power, cruelty to animals. Well, wherever you look on this planet, you will find it in one form or another. You will find violence and cruelty and injustice and abuse of power and corruption perpetrated by humans against other humans. Against children, animals, against nature, against the planet itself. Just, you would be overwhelmed if you knew what is happening on the planet, even at this moment, what humans are doing to other humans, even at this moment. And it's been going on ever since anybody can remember, recorded history and beyond. And of course there are certain pockets where that is particularly pronounced or marked. So wherever you look, you see that unconsciousness, humans, so identified with their form that they are totally trapped in it, so identified with the mental form of me that other forms are dead. They have deadened their sensitivity through identification with mind-made images, so they don't know what they are doing to other humans because they have reduced other humans to mere labels, mental labels. They have attached judgments, images, and labels onto other humans. And now, anything is possible, any act of violence, through conceptualizing other human beings. And what you do to others, you do to yourself. So in the case of certain, let's say, this is only one example, terrorists is one example, but respectable scientists working on chemical weapons, and so this is another, how do you cut, there's no end to it. But let's just, how can a terrorist commit an act, kill thousands of people? Well, before he can do it, he has to reduce those human beings to a mental concept. He has to attach a label to them. And that's what he does in the case of Muslim terrorists, and it's not confined to that religion. Christians did many similar things a few hundred years ago. They would kill anybody who they could label as heretic or whatever label they had, didn't quite believe what we believe. Kill him. The terrorist, just to put the label of unbeliever onto a group of people, for some who are so identified with mind, that's just that simple label already deadens, they have reduced these human beings to a mental concept, and they're now called unbelievers. Once you have reduced human beings to a concept, you can do anything to them and won't sense and feel it anymore. It's a tiny example. And so you're so identified with a form, totally identified with a form, that all other forms are alien to you. And you can do anything to them, to use them, or in fear, try to kill them because they might do something to you. So really, it's a total identification with conceptual identity, which you manufacture for yourself and for others. And so you don't know the aliveness that is there. You don't know that anymore, because you inhabit a conceptual reality. And that conceptual reality is amplified, the madness of that is amplified by the pain that you carry inside, that's been there for so long, the pain body, that energizes and amplifies the already mad conceptual reality. So all the pain flows into those mental concepts, and then any act of violence is possible, or exploitation. What you're doing to the planet, they don't know. When they see a forest totally identified with mind, it's immediately labeled as they see only timber, perhaps, and how much it costs. They look at it through their mental conditioning. Wherever you look on the planet, humans are manifesting that degree of unconsciousness. That's what it is. Now, of course you could feel angry about it, you could feel sad about it, you can feel upset about it. It's only normal, isn't it? But to look through it and see also here the impersonal nature of what is being done. Not to manufacture an identity for those people or groups of people or tribes or religions, doesn't matter, not to make an identity out of the manifestation of unconsciousness and say that's who they are evil, that is their nature. It's what it may look like that when you look at it on the surface. But ultimately, all evil reveals itself as total identification with form, which implies total identification with mind. Complete absence of an observing presence, witness, not the slightest gap, you're totally in mind. And so, of course, it is tempting to make that into an identity. You can do it for yourself, too, because you can look back on your life at a time when you were less conscious than you are now, and you may have done certain things in your life when you were younger to other people. You may have failed to do something that you should have done, perhaps in relation to your children, whatever it may be. So you may have done something or failed to do something that now you see as bad. It is very tempting and to incorporate this, which after all was only the manifestation of human unconsciousness through this form. It's very tempting to make an identity for yourself out of that and say, I did that, that was me. Then it gets incorporated into the unpleasant story of me. It becomes part of the mind-created image of who I am. So and the ego will hang on even to that. Anything that gives food to strengthen your identity, your mind-made identity, the ego, which is the mind-made self, will grasp that. And it will happily grasp at guilt. Because guilt is to identify yourself with the movement of unconsciousness that happened through this form and say, that was my identity, me. I did that, me. So it gives you, it strengthens enormously your mind-made sense of self. And this is why it's hard when you do not look through that mechanism. People find it hard to get rid of guilt, the feeling that I am bad because I did that. And so they don't see, they make an identity for themselves out of something that was the expression of human unconsciousness. And the same thing for others. You can do it to others, say that is who they are. And then you may begin to want to fight those people because you must fight evil. So you get drawn into having enemies. You create enemies and it looks so just. It is a just cause, but you are attacking. And without knowing it, you get very subtly drawn into unconsciousness through attacking unconsciousness, manifestations of unconsciousness. Very subtly, you get drawn into that yourself. It does not mean that you cannot take action in order to remedy certain manifestations of unconsciousness, but all that is secondary to getting to the root of human unconsciousness, which of course is in each one. Getting to the root of it in yourself as mind identification, becoming free of that. Then you can also, of course, you can at the same time also do good where you see it's needed, help people, yes, but being careful that you don't create enemies to fight. This will draw you into unconsciousness. And before you know it, you do the same things that those people that you're fighting against. So to see then also here the non-personal nature of human dysfunction, of human madness, through those forms what is being expressed is the human condition in its present evolutionary stage, which is coming to an end, this stage, fortunately. But you see it still everywhere. So don't make it into an identity, nor for an identity for yourself about something that you did once, nor something that you observe in others. And that's called forgiveness. Forgiveness means not to mistake human unconsciousness for who that human being is. The opposite of forgiveness is to make that mistake. So forgiveness is simply to see through that and see the true meaning of forgiveness, that there is nothing to forgive. That is the true meaning of forgiveness. It's all contained in, because we have this beautiful, that image of the cross and Jesus that contains so much wisdom, that you could all in contained in that image. And it's all contained in the last words of Jesus, which were, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." He did not make an identity for those people out of what they did to him. Now, "they know not what they do" means, in modern terminology, they are unconscious. So if he had lived now, he probably would have said, "they are completely unconscious. It's okay. They don't know." So forgiveness arises as you stop manufacturing mind-created identities for people. And then you become a manifestation of a different consciousness in this world. And your presence is then enough to change the world, because that transformation of consciousness has already happened within you. Very tempting. That non-forgiveness is very tempting, and its mind and its ego. Similarly, your parents, you might find you may still have some resentment, some of you. They expressed human unconsciousness. They didn't have a choice. looks as if they had a choice. But that comes only in with presence. And that's the choice to be free of mind. Talked about the new consciousness arising, even as the old is getting louder in the world, can that also be on an individual basis? I find the stronger presence gets in this room, form, the more dramatic the pain body gets when it arises. Could you talk a little about this? This quite often, that as presence arises, you experience your pain body more acutely, more, almost it feels sometimes as if it came up all at once. And of course, the pain body is trying to sabotage presence. We are not making the pain body into an enemy, but this is what the pain body tries to do. So you simply see that this is what it tries to do. So it will create, it can be such, so much so that I'm tempted to say almost that it can be to such an extreme that it looks as if you were being faced with your entire karma all at once. But ultimately, it comes up to sabotage, but the fact that it comes up is the opportunity for it to rise up into the light of consciousness and be transmuted there. So it is right and good that it should come up, because there is sufficient presence, although it tries to sabotage presence. There is enough presence in you to meet it in that state of attention and allowing. And that's an accelerated transmutation that many people now experience, especially those people in whom presence is arising very quickly, who come into contact with this or other teachings that in slightly different ways point to the same. So as presence arises, the transmutation of all that accumulated pain also accelerates. So that you are right, there is an equivalent movement, what you see in the outer world, the old and the new, the old becoming more mad, even as the new arises, to the extent that you know how usually television expresses only the old consciousness, with relatively rare that it anything new comes through that is a manifestation of the liberation from mind. To the extent that this teaching was on national television in Canada in the evening news for 3 minutes. All the other news were, of course, about the violence in the Middle East and this and there and the killings there and the uprisings there. And suddenly there was, teacher here. How did this get into the news? And then I hadn't realized how closely the two go together, the this would have been inconceivable even a couple of years ago to have something that isn't news. I've always been saying this is underground. This is happening underground. It's not news, and yet it's appearing even in the media that it filters through here and there. Of course, they had to have a little thing to make it appear as if it were newsworthy, and they said, who is this teacher who stills the minds of the rich and famous? Oh, that's news. But the producer actually knew what he was doing. And he knew that he needed that little thing to get it in there. Otherwise, his boss wouldn't have allowed it in. So he had to get this in, and it got in. So it's there. It's no longer totally underground. And then the equivalent thing within human beings, the madness is still there. Even as the new arises. And at times, the wave of madness, which is both mind identification and the amplified mind through the pain body, can come in very powerful waves. And you can feel, oh! And yet, there's a reason why this is happening. The transmutation is accelerating. It has to come up into the light of presence. The pain body cannot be transmuted if it doesn't come up into the light of presence. Now, the pain body, I'm talking about the pain body as if it were an entity and it's a perspective on it. The pain body really wants to sabotage it to get food back from your mind. It wants to take your mind over again, so it comes up very strongly. But it doesn't know that there is a greater, larger reason why it's coming up, and that is because it needs to become transmuted. And perhaps deep down it wants to become transmuted. Trying to sabotage really is wanting to dissolve, wanting to become dissolved into consciousness. So you're faced sometimes with waves of pain or madness in your life, and just, well, what can you do? Just be there, if you can, and watch that. And occasionally you will get lost in it. That's part of it too. And then you wake up out of it again. And perhaps next time a witnessing presence remains even as the wave sweeps through you. And if there is a witnessing presence, even if only in the background, the wave will move through more quickly. If there's no witnessing presence, it gets lodged in here and it can hang on. Through witnessing presence, the pain body comes up, perhaps very strongly, and you will experience it as an energy movement through you, which you may even shake with anger or fear as that happens. The body may shake as this energy comes up and you meet it in the state of acceptance and surrender. There's a fear, and you allow it to happen, allow it to be, even as the body shakes. One could say you are suffering, if you can even call that suffering, because if there's an observing presence, it's just pain. So you're getting through the end of suffering. Are you still suffering? A little bit. And you suffer consciously by allowing that pain movement to be there. You suffer. It's okay. That's enormous. be powerful to bring that acceptance into the suffering, and then it's not suffering anymore. It's simply pain. Suffering requires an entity, a me, with a story, with mind activity around it, and a story around it. A suffering entity. But now you realize the pain body is simply energy movement. Non-personal. Nobody's. It's not you. So that's the... So when it comes, in those of you in whom it comes strongly, welcome it as it comes. If you lose yourself in it, it takes you over. Okay. That was it. And next time, see if you can be there as it arises and accept it. Is it beneficial to the practice of being present to live in an ashram or monastery? If so, are there any you recommend? Visited quite a few. And everywhere they seem to be struggling with the same things, whether it's in the monastery or in the outside world. They're having the same conflicts and the same struggles in the utopian communities. Mm-hmm. And you look underneath the surface. And you find it's the same as the board meeting in the corporation when they get together. So you can go to a monastery or ashram, realizing it's fine, you can surrender there, or you can surrender in everyday life as a householder, surrender there. It doesn't really matter where you surrender. Of course, there are certain monasteries or groups where people come together in order to be present with varying degrees of success. It helps to be with people who are also going through this transformation, entering presence, sangha, to have a community. It doesn't necessarily have to be a place where you live, but to get together occasionally in the state of presence, either in stillness or listen to a talk that comes out of presence and then go into stillness, that can be helpful. Often people ask me, when are you going to have your center? And I said, well, it may be happening. It hasn't happened yet. Who knows? Any kind of organization, ashram, whatever it may be, you will find, unless with the people already free, they will bring in their mind structures. Even if their reason for being there is freedom, they still carry with them the mind structures. And there have been many examples of utopian communities who degenerated very quickly into the same madness that you see in the outside world. Their intentions were good. The whole of communism, the intentions were good behind it. Equality, justice, no ownership, wonderful. But they thought the answers were in some organizational structure. Change that. Not realizing whatever you create out of your state of consciousness is a reflection of that state of consciousness, and they hadn't looked at that. So communism, in order to achieve a better world, a future projection, first they had to kill about 10 million people in their own countries. In order to get their future, salvation was in the future. And the moment, the now, was a means to getting there. And if the now is a means to getting to a mental projection of future, the now becomes hell. And you can do that to yourself on a personal level, or you can do it collectively if you as a group need to get to a future projection. So I would recommend that you visit some monasteries and see how it goes. Visit, see how you feel there. Buddhist, whatever it may be, Hindu, Buddhist, Christian. Am I ever going to have a center? I don't know. What's it going to be like? I don't. Is it going to generate into egoic madness? Who knows? Surrender wherever you are. Wherever you are, now is the right place for your practice of surrender. That is the primordial truth. Not seek a situation that is more conducive to surrender. Seek a situation that is more conducive. It may change. Your external situation is more likely to change if you surrender now. If presence arises now, then it's more likely to change. But to say the external change is a prerequisite for my practice, that is a fallacy. Wherever you are, whatever condition, whatever state, surrender to that. No demand that this moment should be different, that this place should be different. A total alignment with what is. And then, who knows, perhaps suddenly an ashram grows around you before you know it, especially in India. This is easier to happen in India. You just need to sit under a tree, and if you're present and surrendered. Of course, there are many who pretend also, I know that. There are many who pretend because it's a living. They couldn't do that in the West, because whether you're real or not real, they won't recognize you. But here, if you sit under a tree or in a cave, somebody will find you. And somebody will know that, be drawn to you, to the state of consciousness that you embody, and they'll come with some food. And then 2 years later, somebody else will come. And then two more, and then some more people sitting under trees around you. And then before you know it, there's a little ashram. All that doesn't happen in the West, it's beautiful, it's unstructured. There's nobody saying, okay, let's have a planning committee. You are in charge of that, you're in charge of that. Now let's go and do it. Whereas here's organically, it suddenly comes into being. And that's beautiful. Less egoic intervention, not that some egos will get in there too, of course they will. And then if you're unlucky, a Western person will come and write a book about you. You to the West, and then where the problems start. I'm joking a little. It is wonderful that so much of the essence of the spirituality of this country has spread now throughout the world. Beautiful phenomenon. India has been this like a seed with, it's one of these seeds you blow and all the seeds go. And that's happened fairly recently. And very quickly, and that's part of that transformation. That ancient wisdom that was there had been there for thousands of years. Now it's flowing there and it's still the same, and yet there's enormous intensity to it now, because of the evolutionary stage that we are at on the planet. One could almost say that all those thousands of years were in preparation, getting ready for this evolutionary transformation on the planet. And we have come a long way in just half a century. I read recently, I picked up Paul Brunton's book, In Search of Secret India, through which Ramana Maharshi became known in the West. And in the introduction, he's trying very hard to convince the reader that India has something to offer to the West, which was maybe 1930 or whenever it was written. Trying to convince that it's something valuable. And now you don't need convincing anymore. Nobody needs convincing anymore. Then we have this strange phenomenon, which is very recent. Western spiritual teachers, unheard of. They haven't existed since the Middle Ages. The last spiritual teachers were the Christian mystics in Europe. And after that, all you had was institutionalized religion, mind stuff. Of course, maybe a few accidental realizations here and there, but they were quickly killed or shut away. And now it's like appearing everywhere. It's Western spiritual teachers. In the West, it's still, you can't, spiritual teacher to many is a meaningless term. What do you do for a living? Spiritual, what's that? And yet it's growing. So, and that's, for many of them, the seed was here. They were seeded here. This teacher, to this form, it happened accidentally, but after that, I was drawn to certain expressions of Indian spirituality through Ramana Maharshi and Krishnamurti, and I realized through them what had happened to me. was a strong, immediate sense of connected, deep connectedness, if not to say oneness. So then people asked me often, have you been to India? And then they were surprised when I said, no, I've never been to India. What? You haven't been to India? And you are a spiritual teacher? And I said, I carry India in here because India represents the inner dimension and the West represents the outer, one could say. And so I always felt drawn to that. Never felt really, not after the transformation, that I feel like a Westerner. India is the inner. Not that it does not manifest also human madness that is universal on the planet. Of course you have manifestations of human madness in different forms here. That is universal. And yet, it's the cradle of the transformation of consciousness. Attention to the resistance of the present, if powerful enough, will dissolve that resistance and a state of presence will emerge. What will dissolve the central core of the self so that it doesn't create endless waves of resistance? Can we explore the nature of the realization that is necessary? What will dissolve the central core of self so that it doesn't create endless waves of resistance? Central. What is the central core of self? The mind structures, the mind movements that are the mental image of me with its accumulated content, plus the pain body, the two in cooperation form the central core of self. So, what will dissolve that? Of course, that's easy. Surrender. Only now. Surrender. It's too easy, isn't it? It's too simple. Surrender. Whatever form this moment takes, then the self cannot survive in the state of surrender to what is. It's as simple as that. The pain body cannot renew itself when you surrender to the fact that there is a pain body. And so surrender, I'm not telling you from now on you need to be in continuous surrender for 24 hours a day. Oh no. It's not that difficult. It's only this moment that you need to surrender to. Not just this. Whatever form this takes, it's always this. And that you meet in and through surrender. That you can do. You can't surrender for 24 hours a day. That's a problem. But just this. It's only now. And so, the egoic self, nor the pain body, can survive in surrender. And so, and then the question may arise, well, how long is it going to take before the central core of self and my pain body have dissolved? And that question implies that surrender is not yet complete. is this moment that bad that you need to get to a future one where you achieve a certain state? To realize the goodness and depth that is already here. And only through surrender you realize that. Who you are already. You are greater than in your wildest egoic dreams you could ever be. You are already greater than you could ever be, even if the wildest egoic dreams of achievement became realized. Now, already, you are that. And you're not going to be closer to God at some future point than you are now. And God is yourself, the deepest level of your being. You are not going to get closer than you are now. You're already so close that you're not even two. Nor is anybody closer than you are to God. If you want to be in silence for the rest of the day, feel free to do so. Tomorrow you will do your own thing or do nothing. We may have a complete day of silence on Thursday. In the meantime, every moment is now, and no matter where you go or what you do, whether you stay here tomorrow in silence or go out and experience this or that, see this or that, don't walk around as a heavy person, just a field of presence, and perceive through that beautiful stillness that is there in you. If you go somewhere, perceive the multiplicity of forms, the beauty of it. Be as much free of mental labeling as possible. Surrendered to this moment.